Am I on? Hello. Can you hear me? Wonderful. Wonderful. For some reason, your volume was a little low, so I just want to make sure you can hear me. And of course, you can let me know if that doesn't work out. Well, happy Easter for those of you who celebrate Easter, and for those who don't, we want to take a look at what that message is from another perspective. In many ways, A Course in Miracles is about resurrection. And that word is different from the word renaissance. Renaissance means rebirth. Resurrection has a different implication, which is one was alive, one deadens oneself, and then one must come back to life. So that has a little bit of a different quality to it than rebirth. And that is so what the course is for. It says, obviously, we are alive, but we've gotten ourselves into a real pickle, so to speak, where life seems anything for many people other than constant joy and blessing and beauty and everything else. So I want to try, as it does, to set the stage for what's really happening. And why the course is so repetitious in trying to get it to us to change our minds the way it does. So I want to tell you about my late brother, who died in 2004, a long time ago, of Parkinson's disease and another complication. And one has to take a certain kind of medication when one has Parkinson's disease that causes in many people hallucinations. And he was troubled with awful hallucinations. And he would plead with me to make the people stop coming into his room. We would have to, the people in the assisted living where he ended up having to spend his last year or so, they would have to push the chairs up against the two closets in the room because he decided that was the only way that the snakes and the rats in the closet would stay there. Or he was absolutely sure that people were climbing in the windows and trying to tie him up in his bed. Now, it did absolutely no good to try to explain to him that none of that was happening because from his perspective, it was. I found that out in the early times of his illness when we were someplace for dinner when he could still walk up and down steps and so on. And it was late in the afternoon, and the sun was shining in the window, and it was causing a chair rail to cast a long shadow on the floor. And he said, "Oh, there's a snake over there on the floor." And so, thinking that logic was going to work, this was early on in my experience with this, I said, "That's not a snake, that's just a shadow that is cast by the sun coming in." I was being all scientific about all of this. And I said, "Okay, I'm going to show you that this isn't really a snake. And I'm going to go over and touch this, and you'll see that everything's fine." So I go over and put my hand on the shadow, and he gets this alarmed look on his face because my logic didn't change what he was seeing. So this, in many ways, is the best example that I can think of to try to help all of us see what the Course in Miracles is saying our predicament is. That we are basically in a hallucinating state. We haven't gone anywhere. We haven't changed our basic nature, but we are completely not in touch with what's really going on. He was unable to be in touch with what was actually happening in many parts of the room, and there's no way anybody could get inside his hallucination and fix it for him. Because it was all an imaginary thing in his head. Now, A Course in Miracles says you cannot evaluate a system from within it. we are, of course, within our own hallucinating situation. Well, I was not in his. So I could look and see he was perfectly fine. Trucks weren't driving through the room. People weren't climbing through the window. In other words, listen to this because it's important, is that nothing in the room was actually changed because of his hallucination. And the same with us. Nothing has happened to the truth of us. That's why those lessons that say, I am still as God created me, are so important, and why it's so repetitive throughout the whole thing. In other words, nothing about our eternal, infinite, beautiful words that are hard for us to even begin to apply to ourselves, but maybe we must learn to do that. It's like all of that is still right this second, right where you are, right where I am. That's still the truth, but we can't see it, or we haven't up to this point, because our hallucination, you might say, has taken up all the airspace. In other words, that's all that we're focused on, and that has our attention. Now, because that's all that we see, we have lost track that there's anything else going on. Is that not true? This certainly seems like a very real world that we have to negotiate our way through and solve problems in, and so on and so forth. So the course tries to tell us, no, that's not the way it is. Your hallucination is caused by, as it eloquently says, the tiny mad idea that kind of floated through our minds. But let's say, to be more specific about it, our hallucination is fueled by our own sense of guilt, our own fear that we have, in fact, ruined ourselves, left home, kind of like the prodigal son in the Bible story is just left out wandering on our own, so to speak. So this is the dilemma. When we try to solve a problem at the level of the problem, it can't work because, first of all, what we're trying to solve in reality isn't even happening. And we have to see, if you can imagine a cartoon, you know, we have a lot of animations and so on in our online series, which I can tell you more about later. But if you could imagine a cartoon where you've got some kind of a funny looking Rube Goldberg machine that is cranking out all of the elements that make up a hallucination, and we're supplying the raw material for it. So as long as the raw material that I supply is I feel guilty and all of those things that we unfortunately learned in our early days, variations on that theme about I'm not okay and I'm unworthy or undeserving or nobody cares for me or life doesn't work out or something like that. When those ideas and beliefs and thoughts are the raw material of ideas that are fed into my hallucination making machine, I'm going to end up with a life experience that's the exact to the smallest little amount equivalent of what I'm saying in my mind and what I believe. So that's why we can't fix it at the level of the problem, and why we basically are imprisoned because we don't understand the process that we're participating in, which is I'm continuing to shoot myself in the foot and I don't realize how I'm doing this. So then we want to call on Bill Thetford's, I know it's hopeless, just not serious. I used to love to say that. So this seems hopeless, but it's not serious in the sense that there is a way out. And A Course in Miracles is all about this is the way out. It is a teaching of non-duality. We've talked about that. It's unique in all of the teachings of non-duality that seem to be floating around out here for the past 5,000 years or so, in that it focuses on our relationships as the fast way to understand what we're doing to ourselves. So the first thing is to just take a deep breath and settle in and say, yes, we're hallucinating. I am creating every single solitary aspect, including all of what seem to be the punishing aspects, the people who don't treat us right, the not having enough of this, the being confounded by that, you know, your car breaking down in traffic someplace, whether it's a large thing or a small thing, it's all an exact picture of the things, the non-loving, fear-driven, guilt-driven ideas that I have been hanging on to, and I have had no idea how this system has worked or how damaging to my peace of mind in every respect hanging on to these ideas are. We just thought, well, this is true. Or if we thought anything at all about it, it's like, well, you know, they're just my thoughts and they don't matter. They're invisible and nobody can see them and nobody knows what's going on. It's like, oh dear, well, our entire lives show up as the outpicturing of what's going on in our mind. So this hallucinated state, so to speak, the Course refers to as our wrong mind. It's our crazy mind, but it's definitely the wrong mind. So when we observe life, so to speak, or try to live life in this hallucinating state, it just doesn't work out. It can't work out. It's a self-defeating process. So, however, we do have something comes to our rescue, which is using the Christian language that it uses, because it had to be written in some language, and that's what it was. There is a functionality in our mind. It's called the Holy Spirit. You can call it anything you want, as long as you understand what the function is, which is, back to my example about my brother, I was not inside his hallucination, so I could see that he was just fine. I also could see that he was terrified. I knew there was nothing for him to be terrified about. He was safe. He was being taken care of. He had very excellent care. No worries. Well, the same with this Holy Spirit, loving, wise aspect of love, so to speak, that is also a thought process in my mind, just like this guilt, fear thing is a process in my mind. But this part knows that we're lost in this hallucination, also knows we're still at home, at fine, nothing's happened, everything's in good shape, and it's the function of this Holy Spirit to be this bridge. In other words, to know how distressed we are, to see what's going on, and also know it's not real. Now, sometimes I hear newer course facilitators or something, if someone asks a question about a problem they have, they say, oh, kind of, you don't have to worry about it, it's all an illusion. It's like, well, that's true in one sense, but that makes no sense when you say that while you're in the illusion. The only way you can legitimately say that is when you're outside the illusion. In other words, I could see that my brother's issues were not real issues, but he couldn't. So that's why I couldn't try to explain to him why there wasn't somebody climbing in the window. As far as he was concerned, there was, and it would have been dismissive and unkind and unloving to continue down that track. So we're given a process by which we can start to come out of this hallucinated state. And the first step, since we can't just go from hallucinating to, okay, now everything's done, it's a process. And it refers to changing the world that we're in to the real world. And that is our time and space life, where we seem to be associated with bodies and discrete things and needing to pay the rent and raise the kids and do the right thing on the planet and so on. But we're going to continue to do that from an increasingly loving place. In other words, we're going to get the idea, if it's my current set of to them and that sort of thing, that I need the slow, usually it's slow, process of upgrading my thinking, which is why the course is so long and so repetitious, because it knows all of this seems very weird to us and it can't possibly really be true. This surely is reality, and so on and so forth. So it's like, okay, going to take you by the hand and one step at a time, keep leading you through. Here's what you now believe. Change your mind with this. From our perspective in the world, we would call it rewiring your brain. In other words, a constant shift from a fearful, guilt-ridden perspective to one that's more loving, that's more open, that's more accurate, because anything that's loving is more accurate. So if you can, I hope that makes sense. I hope you can see that our guilt calls always for punishment. You see, that's why the Course wants to have us downgrade our sense of guilt and sin to the idea that we've made a mistake. Obviously, we made a really pretty major mistake. We didn't realize that we couldn't leave our power behind. It's like all of our power comes with us. And boy, we've done a great job of creating this hallucination, so to speak, down to the absolutely very last detail. So in the problem with, so if we could just see that this was a mistake, it's a mistake because we haven't changed reality. We haven't changed our basic, infinite, loving nature. That's why it's a mistake and not a sin. A sin would say reality has now been ruined because of what I've done. That would be like my brother actually completely changed entirely the whole building he was in because of his hallucination. Well, that didn't happen. But as long as we fear we have, you have to see that guilt and punishment are two sides of the same coin. You can't have just the heads or the tails of a coin. You're going to get both sides. And as long as we insist that we or someone else is guilty, then this unfortunate punishing hallucination is going to be maintained, because I'm going to keep maintaining it on a moment by moment basis. And no matter how much we, whatever we say about how much we are going to try to solve this, you might say at the level of the problem, it can't be done because we haven't realized how we were doing this in the first place. I hope that makes sense. I wish I could see you. I normally, when I do classes and workshops, they're highly interactive and there's a lot of questions back and forth. So it's like, I know you're there, but I can't see you. So I hope that makes sense. If you have a question, by all means, feel free to ask it at any time. So the whole point of this is to say, we have to keep helping you see you're still beloved, you're still perfect as you were created, and you haven't ruined anything. You have not changed yourself, you haven't ruined anything, so you don't need to be punished. So what happens, and I'm sure those of you who have been around the Course for a long time have seen this in action, that as you let up on yourself or anyone else and stop declaring yourselves or someone else guilty, in other words, we're going to start to let go of the whole victim and villain thing and change your mind, things get different in your life. And there's not any apparent time and space reason for them to be different. And you go, well, this is really quite miraculous. How did that just happen? Because we're used to thinking that there's cause and effect in the world. So you look around at some nicer thing that's happened and you think, I can't find how that could have happened. Well, there isn't anything causative in the hallucination. The hallucination is strictly an effect. So all cause is with where I'm putting my attention. So if we start to follow and practice these lessons and get this brain rewiring underway, and we start to say, you know what? I do want to look at this kind of big mess that I've made here, or that it appears that I have made. I now want to observe it, live in it, make my decisions with this right mind, Holy Spirit function. In other words, I now want to look at it through a different lens, a different perspective, different eyeglasses, different anything you can think of to help you see my perspective looking from my wrong mind is the world is real. I'm this little small thing in it. There's a bunch of trouble going on. I'm a problem. Everybody else is a problem and all is lost. Well, that's not a perspective that's going to really get us anywhere. So if we could be persuaded that our take on things is not accurate, it's not evil, it's not criminal, it's just not accurate. So we want to move over here to something that is. So from this loving Holy Spirit perspective that says, okay, really and truly, you and everybody else in here is still loving, beloved, at home, valuable. Would you like to look at them that way? Would you like to look at yourself that way? And usually in the beginning, the answer is no, because I'm really the victim or I'm really the villain and they really did it. And, we're convinced of this cause and effect activity in the world. And so we're not really very cooperative with this process. And the author of the course knows we're not cooperative with this process, which is why it's so lightweight at the beginning. It's not very insistent about things because it knows we just can't wrap our heads around the fact that this could really be a big hallucination. So then it amps up as you go through the workbook and also as you go through the text, where it gets more extreme as we go through. So if we decide, you know what, I'm over living the small life or the painful life or the whatever the unsatisfactory life it might be now, and you begin to see that everything you've done to try to fix it has either not worked at all, or if it worked temporarily, it's been short-lived. So when we finally get to the place to say, okay, how I'm approaching whatever my problems are just are not working, and I can't seem to prevent new ones from showing up. So, okay, I'm ready to listen to this. And so little by little, we go, well, it seems like these people don't deserve to be treated kindly because they're so awful, but okay. And so little by little, we're willing to look at things differently. And the more I realize and see the value of, you know what, I'm going to have to convince myself instead of I'm wrong and so are they, I'm going to have to flip this over 180 degrees to I'm going to start the process of convincing myself and wanting and desiring that all of us are good, all of us are valuable, all of us are still beloved, all of us are amazing. That's the way I want to see it. And when that's what I want to see, when that becomes my goal, and the course is just this one great, big, long, endless repetition of this same idea to help us because nothing can release us from this hallucination we're in except us. It's like Nothing can reach in and sort of lift us out. We have to be willing to see out of the other part of our mind. So we've got this all the help in the world available to us, but we must avail ourselves of this help. I hope that makes sense. So if we were going to look at relationships, because of course a sense of being punished comes in a lot of ways, but the pain that we experience through relationships is probably at the top of the list. I mean, there are natural disasters, there's financial problems, health problems, and so on, all of which are derivatives of our relationship problems. So that's why the course, starting about the middle of the text, starts hammering away at the whole relationship thing. And so I don't think we did this in either of the first two times that we've spent together. But if you could imagine a diagram, and the diagram would look like, if you could imagine a vertical line, just a line on a piece of paper, and the top of the line is your conscious mind. So this is like what we can do from within the hallucination where we find ourselves. And then down at the bottom of the line is your unconscious mind. Well, I'm sure you know that there is a tiny, tiny little fraction percentage in your conscious mind as compared to all of the stuff that's in the unconscious mind, which from within the hallucination in the world of time and space perspective, starting from the moment we're born and even before in utero, we're downloading, shall we say, units of information, sights, sounds, energy fields, all kinds of stuff, at the impossible to imagine rate of about 20 million units of information per second. Can you imagine how filled up our unconscious minds are with all kinds of unhelpful ideas? And we couldn't possibly properly connect the dots when we were little and starting to learn what being alive was all about. So, in any event, we m much of the guilt that we harbor that's creating all of the experiences in our world, we may not recognize is there. I remember myself when I was first a student, and it kept talking about guilt this and guilt that, and I thought, well, I don't know what this is about, but I don't feel guilty. Well, at least not much. And I thought, well, this is really actually sort of insulting. This sounds like an accusation. You are a guilty person. Oh, well, of course, as all Course in Miracles students find out, there is way more guilt and pain over what we fear we have done than we have any idea about. So it's not just what we're aware of consciously, it's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on unconsciously that's contributing to the specifics down to the last detail of our daily life. And since you can't go directly from your conscious mind to your unconscious mind, a lot of stuff is in there because we don't want to know what it is. Besides the fact, a lot of it's there, we have no idea how it got there. Some things we just deny on purpose. In other words, that's a deliberate thing. We just look the other way. Well, the Course knows if I'm going to be dragging around a bunch of guilt that I don't even know I'm dragging around, and that's contributing to the problem, then we have to find a way to get what's going on in my unconsciousness into my conscious mind so I can make another better decision than the one I've made now. So, enter stage left, my relationships. So, over here on one side, let's say here's a somebody that drives you crazy. You can probably think of at least one person who drives you crazy. And you can probably think of exactly what it is that drives you crazy. You can think, what I don't like about them is, fill in the blank. Just do that right now in your own mind. Think, okay, this is the person that currently is at the top of my list of people that I find annoying or infuriating or whatever. And here's why. Here's the behavior that I don't like or that I find deeply painful or hurtful or whatever. Okay. And so that person's behavior, you kind of imagine that you're drawing now a little dotted line between your conscious mind up here over to an angle, and then another little dotted line from the person down to your unconscious mind. So you've created a triangle on the page, if you can envision that in your mind. Okay, now, if you can't get to what's in your unconscious mind, by definition, we need a mechanism to access it some other way. The relationships provide that, because your conscious mind can see, I can see what that person's doing. They're being a jerk and whatever all else they may be being. Well, that person is standing there being a perfect mirror of something that's going on in your unconscious mind that you feel deeply distressed over. You feel guilty about it, you feel heartbroken about it. It's like all variations of, I'm so upset that I'm this way. So here they are. They're out here living out what needs to be released in your mind about you. Remember, this whole reclamation project that the Course is taking us through, we're reclaiming our freedom from all of these beliefs that are causing us to live in painful, unsatisfactory circumstances. That doesn't mean every single part of your life is painful and uncomfortable, but it means enough of it is that you wish it would stop. So this is the reclaiming our freedom. Listen to this. We're reclaiming our freedom from the imprisoned state we're in, much of it caused by what we don't even know is going on. So it's like, well, then we've got to help you see what's going on. And that's why the Course focuses on healing through relationships much more dramatically than any of the other known teachings on non-duality. So here, when we see a person, let's say that something that you secretly fear about yourself is that you're very much not okay because you're dishonest about something. And so here you've got somebody who is, they're either dishonest in what they say, they lie, or they steal stuff and they don't tell you about it, or they hide things, or in whatever their behavior may be, you would label it, they just don't tell the truth. They're being dishonest. And we say, and here's the key, pay attention. We say, they make me so angry or upset because they're so dishonest. Well, they don't do any such thing. They stand there being such a close fit to what we accuse ourselves of, that it triggers the wound in my own mind, the guilt in my own mind, the pain in my own mind for my own deception, for my own dishonesty, or whatever the issue may be. I'm just throwing that out as an example. So this person stands over here as a trigger or a catalyst. They're just being however they are, but what they're doing is triggering my pain, the wound that I carry with me over my guilt, my fear about what I've done to myself or possibly somebody else. So this person is showing up, and I think I told you the last time that a friend of mine used to say, or maybe, I don't know, I told somebody recently, maybe not you all, that our relationships fit us like a tailor-made Hong Kong suit. That the way we see somebody behaving or hear the words they're saying are such an exact, specific fit to something that I feel guilty about, that they have the capacity to just get in there behind all my defenses and hit that woundedness to make me aware of my distress, so to speak. So the upset that I feel, listen carefully, the upset that I feel is not caused by them. The upset I feel is caused by myself, by hanging on to this guilt. And I change my body chemistry and I do all kinds of stuff as a result of this. But once, if you can connect the dots properly and see that the troublesome people are a pointer to say, if we could put the words, we could do one of those little balloon things that comes out of a cartoon person's mouth, then this person would be saying, I'm standing here reminding you and being a perfect mirror about something you're accusing yourself of. You don't know it. You're hurting yourself unnecessarily. You're still pure. You're still good. You're still beloved. You're still at home. And would you like to quit? So this would be, if we could kind of make a cartoon of this, that's what it would be. And so we have the option of seeing this rather than, oh, well, that was a mistake. I can let this go. Now, the reason why I heal through relationships is, okay, the way I'm going to respond to this person out here is the way I'm responding to myself. So if I should say, I think that person is just awful, and what I'm going to do is just cut them out of my life, or I'm going to yell at them, or I'm going to send them an ugly email, or I'm in some way going to condemn them, then guess who is going to be the recipient of that condemnation and double the guilt, so to speak? That would be us. That would be you. So we're told, would you be willing to have a different response to the troublesome person who's standing out here showing you what you accuse yourself of? Because if you could see this person's behavior, I always feel like I have to talk really slow, like it's so important to get. So I try not to do that, but it's like, I so want you to get this, because you could free yourself of so much pain if you do, if you think, this is me. I'm looking at something I accuse myself of. Now, am I going to see this other person slash my behavior as just an assault on me, or am I going to see this as a call for help? This is my call for help standing out here so I can see it. We so want to be healed. We don't put those words around. We just want to feel better. We just want a better way. We want things to clear out. We want to feel more loved. We want to feel safer. We don't feel safe right now. And when our plea is, there's got to be a better way, or help me have a better life, or however you put words around your call for help, then people often say, you know what? Life got worse rather than better. It's like, well, no, it doesn't get worse. What really happens is all of the distress and the pain and the self-doubt and the guilt that you're carrying around with you, hurting yourself on a daily basis, now starts to show up in your physical world. But it's showing up in your physical world so that if you could put a different spin on this, it would be, okay, you ask to be healed. Here's what you need to let go of in yourself. Here's what needs to be healed within you. We're over here as this cast of characters. I'm waving my hands in the air like you're in my class. It's like over here showing you what you're accusing yourself of, and would you like to stop? Would you like to approach yourself kindly? with compassion, with a greater understanding, or would you just like to punch yourself in the nose? And how you treat this other person is exactly the effect that it will have on you. So over and over and over, in as many ways as we can possibly imagine, the Course keeps trying to make this clear to us. And then it says that our fastest healing, our most effective, our most complete healing can happen through our relationships, and they are never an accident. I do a great deal of relationship counseling, and I see over and over and over how people are drawn together because they have a common issue that needs to be healed, and they're a perfect match. They're a perfect mirror to one another. So mostly we don't get that. We just think the other people in our lives are deliberately trying to drive us crazy. Or if it's not deliberate, they drive us crazy anyway, and we're stuck with them. You know, they're family members, they're the next door neighbors, they're the people you work with. And that's not an accident. It is not an accident that we are tied to certain people, because they are the ones who can be our fastest way to letting go of our own guilt and treating ourselves much more kindly. Now, is the ego mind going to be helpful with you about this? Absolutely not. The ego mind is in there as the first thing, dividing anything, everybody into victims and villains and who did what to whom, and all the reasons why you should stay in a conflicted arrangement with these people. You know why? Because the ego sense of self, which is as fictitious as this hallucination we're living in, requires conflict to stay in its pseudo existence. So it's not going to cooperate with you in letting go of fear, in letting go of pain, in being kind to people. That's not what egos do. If you take a look around into our joint hallucinated state, you can see how in love we are with conflict. And you can see it's like trying to be heard in the midst of all of the, let's go drop some bombs on people, either literally, or let's just assault the people in our neighborhoods or families or jobs, or let me just assault myself some more. It's like conflict and one thing pitted against another is like the lifeblood of the ego mind and of the hallucinated state. So you can't call on the voice of your wrong mind, which is your ego, to be helpful in this matter. This is where you go, okay, I need help from, let's say, the other side of my mind. I need help from another perspective. I want to join forces with this other perspective that's going to allow me to have this much broader picture where we don't divide people into victims and villains and one person does something to somebody else. What I want to now see is we're in this same boat together. We both need the same thing. We both need compassion. We both need understanding. We both need love. The Holy Spirit function in our minds thinks that way. The Holy Spirit's not somebody floating around outside us someplace. It's that voice for love that knows the big picture, that knows the truth, that is living outside of our hallucinated state, just like I was outside my brother's. So that knows the deep yearning and longing in all of us. And it knows that principle that keeps showing up all the way through the workbook lessons, that what we give to others, we strengthen in ourselves. So if what I'm going to do is offer condemnation and guilt to the somebody that I think is dishonest or whatever the transgression might happen to be, then all I'm going to do is sink deeper into my own guilt, and my own life experience will get worse and worse and worse because I'm feeding more guilt rather than less into my hallucination making machinery, so to speak. That's all happening in my mind. So if I could wrap my head around the idea that what I offer to others, I'm the first recipient of, and take that to heart and practice it. You can just practice it very easily and find out it's true. So you think, if it's a person out here in my diagram, that's what I will experience. So with the Holy Spirit in charge, you know, with this voice for love, the voice for the right mind, that inclination that we all have to be loving and kind and compassionate, we haven't lost it. That's a function of our real, true, basic nature. It's been drowned out by the noise of my ego mind and the kind of frantic nature of our daily lives, but it's there. I'll tell you, it's there. The inclination to love, to bless, to be kind to want to join with, all of those are expressions of love, and those are absolutely as alive and well and present and huge and functioning as they always were, always will be. We just have been looking in the opposite direction and have been so hypnotized by the situation we're in that we just haven't paid attention to it. So it hasn't lessened. It hasn't gone away. Our loving nature is still there. It's a matter of attention. We haven't paid attention to it because this noisy ego voice and all of the drama and all the conflict and all the everything else going on, all of our own pain, has kept us, our focus, you might say, singularly over here in my wrong mind. But we don't have to do that. We have an option. We can go, you mean there's a whole different way to live while I'm still here, seemingly with a physical body and seemingly in a physical world and all of this? Yes, I can begin to reclaim my real loving heritage, which is right here waiting to be claimed. And that voice for love, the Holy Spirit, is like right here as close as your breath, waiting for your request, waiting for this to be your choice instead of what's your choice now. Okay, so this is so important to get, that we still have all the power, we still have all the glory, we still have all the opportunity, we have everything in our basic creation right here available to us. And now we're asked for this to be more important than the stuff my ego mind dishes up to us. So that's how relationships in A Course in Miracles are our guide home, because they're our guide to how we are specifically and most deeply hurting ourselves. So I hope that makes sense. I think we should leave time for a few questions. Surely you must have a question. Everybody usually has a, but what about? So anybody with a question? How come you don't have questions? Usually in classes, everybody has a question. So Regina, are you there? Don't you have a question or facilitate a question? Okay, what's that? Oh, do I let go of this?
Yeah, thank you, Carol. In order to hear me, you have to let go of the mic. Thank you very much. First of all, I just want to say that I really appreciate listening to you, and I enjoy it. I enjoy very much the story that you told at the beginning tonight. You also shared it last week about your brother and his hallucinations. I think that's a great image. I suppose my question seems maybe a little unrelated to what you were talking about tonight, but it's a curiosity that I have. So it's about Bill Thetford. And, you know, I read, I had a copy of your book, actually, and someone borrowed it and didn't return it, so I didn't get to finish reading it. But I read another book about Bill Thetford and Helen Schuckman. And I don't remember exactly what that book said, but the impression that I got was that the people who knew Bill really felt that he had awakened and then dropped the body. I was just wondering if you wanted to comment on that, on Bill's life and on his practice of forgiveness, and whether you felt that he had awakened and dropped the body. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yes. About the only other book that really has anything about Bill in it is Ken Wapnick's book called Absence from Felicity, where he talks about how the course came to be. And most of his focus is on Helen because theirs was that very close relationship. Not that he wasn't close with Bill as well, but he and Helen worked together. They had their own kind of relationship going. And in that book, you don't really get the picture of who Bill was at all. You kind of end up thinking, well, Bill was the typist. He was kind of over here in the corner someplace. And as I mentioned before, nothing could be further from the truth. Bill was absolutely a total 50%. They were both 100%, let's put it that way. But it was not only everything he did, it was his energy field that was as involved in bringing this voice forward as it was hers. It was like all of the things that he did and the way that he practiced it. And yes, he did at the when he moved to California, and he lived there for 10 years before he died. His goal, I think I mentioned this earlier, if some of you may remember, when I think I talked about this our first night, that he said, what I'm doing now is practicing forgiveness. Practicing forgiveness, which we will talk more about next time we meet, is this process of continuing to change my mind about just about everything. In other words, I've got to keep changing my mind about the people I don't like. And he had a batch of people he didn't like, just like everybody does. Now, practically everybody in New York, he felt he was healed with, he was complete with, and so on. But there were the sticky ones, Ken and Helen and a few other people that he was still not squared away with until close to the end. And he did become more and more and more lighthearted, more, I mean, he was always a very funny and a very fun person to be around, but that just continued more and more and more and more. And at the very end of his life, and I have to add this phrase here so that you won't think, well, I don't want to be enlightened because then I'm going to die. It's like you can't make that conclusion. He seemed to decide, okay, it's time to drop the body once he had reached that state, but not everybody does. Like Ramana Maharshi reached an enlightened state and lived for, I mean, as we call living, being here in the physical body for decades after that. The Buddha lived after his enlightenment. So you can't make any conclusion about, I don't want to be enlightened because then I have to leave. Don't do that. As it turns out, the last couple of days of his life, he had reached that place where he said he had absolutely let go of everything. In other words, everything was healed with everyone. He had only a sense of loving regard for everyone. And he was a tall, slender man, anyway, 6 foot, several inches, 2 or 3. And he was with Jerry Jampolsky the day before because he was commuting kind of back and forth every couple of months to Tiburon from La Jolla, where he had moved about 2 years before that. But about every 2 months, he came up to see all of the course family, so to speak. And sometimes I would go out there and join them. And because I did that for years when we all spent time together and working together and whatnot. And Judy Skutch said, Whitson said, it was amazing. He came in the door. They were greatly delayed because there had been some terrible traffic accident. And instead of taking the hour to get from the airport to Tiburon, which is across the Golden Gate Bridge, it took about 3.5 hours. And Jerry said, I had never seen Bill like this before, and they were very close friends. He said he was funnier and wittier and more joyous and more just exuding goodwill than he had ever seen him. And so did the another person who joined them for dinner that night. Jerry's wife was out of town at the time, and Judy said he literally could not keep his feet on the ground. She said he was up on his tiptoes. And her husband, Whit Whitson, said exactly the same thing. They were absolutely in agreement about that. And this was the day before the 4th of July. You really should read this book because it's got everything about Bill. There is no other book that's got a complete story of not only Bill's life, but of how the course came to be as Never Forget to Laugh. So if you're interested in both the course and Bill, this is the definitive work, and there won't be any more like it because there's no one left to write it. Plus, the foundation is not making their files available to any, I mean, they're not being in agreement. Nobody else wants to write it anyway because they can't. But in any event, the next day was the 4th of July. I have to, oh, I only have 1 minute. How can I tell you this story? All I can say is the next day, Judy was having a big party, and she said, Bill, I think I'm going to go to the market for a little bit more food. And he said, Judy, you've got tons of food. There are about 35 people coming for the big 4th of July. And she said, I know, but I'm a good Jewish mama and I've got to make sure I have extra. So he said, and he used to go walk every day after breakfast. And they'd had this long, leisurely breakfast. And Whit said he was also just more fun, so happy. He was exuding joy like they had never seen him before. So Bill started out for his daily after breakfast walk. And he said, Judy, I'll meet you at the market. Because she was going to drive up and he was going to walk and meet her there. And he said, if you're finished and ready to come home before I get there, then you just come on home without me. And she was a little struck by that statement. And she said, Bill, you know I would never come home without you. And she was kind of thinking, or go home without you, kind of home with a capital H. And so he starts out the door on his walk. She goes up to get her purse and her car keys and her grocery list or whatever, and a couple of minutes later, pulls out her driveway, starts up the street, and there's Bill dead on the sidewalk. He'd gotten as far as the next door neighbor's house, had a gigantic, what turns out from the autopsy, his heart literally exploded and fell over backwards. The neighbor was a surgeon who happened to be out in his front yard and saw all this happen. And he said he literally just had a giant heart attack, fell over backwards, and that was it. And he said it happened in like a nanosecond. It was all over with. And in any event, every single person who was around him at that latter part of his life agreed. Bill was, I cry when I think of this. It's like he asked for a better way. He got his better way, and he asked for it. He got it. He practiced it. He practiced it, and it delivered the goods. It delivered what it promised to deliver, as it will for all of us when we do what it asks for us to do, which is to let go of all the ways that we are hurting ourselves with the ideas and beliefs that we're holding in our minds. So it's like we're clutching these hurtful beliefs, and this course is trying to kind of pry open the fingers and let us help us let go of these self-inflicted wounds so that we too can come back to this place of joy, which is our birthright. It's right here waiting for us to do this. So anyway, Bill was an amazing human being. He did, he did reach a state of enlightenment. There's no doubt about that. Okay. Well, it looks like we're a little over. So I will look forward to seeing you all next Sunday. In the meantime, find somebody who drives you crazy and practice this. Decide. I'm looking at the self that I'm accused, this is what I'm accusing myself of. Now I'm going to continue to do this, or am I going to let myself off the hook? We're going to either both go up together, we're both going to go down together, and it's my choice. Okay, talk to you all later. Bye.